Yeah, oh, thanks. I'll staple it later. My solutions are posted, so you guys can go ahead and look at them. I don't have a grader, so I may not grade these in as much detail, but we'll see. These are the new proposed office hours. Do those work for you? So if you haven't watched the video of the last lecture, please do go through it. I mean, at the very least, go through the lecture notes for that material. It's really pretty important. It sets the foundation, really, for the rest of this chapter. One thing I had to do to coordinate, do you have your homework, by the way?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Might as well give it to me now.
I'll staple
it in my office, that's fine. You aren't alone. Wow, the man with the stapler. We all have to have our own toolkit to survive in this world. There was one thing before the lecture material that was covered in the last time lecture that you watched online that we hadn't yet quite covered right before that, which is on the bottom of page 6 and top of page 7 in this new numbering system, which is to calculate the time averaged energy flow into the conductor at a surface, at a conducting surface. This will be important when we want to send waves down a real waveguide with finite conductivity. Because there'll be losses, right? And you'll want to understand those losses if you ever have to use a waveguide in the real world. So I want to calculate that time average energy flow into the conducting material. And interesting thing about this is that basically everything is controlled by the H parallel just outside the conductor. That's, you know, the most important thing you need to remember about this situation. Basically, to get the flow, you need the cross product, of course, of E parallel and H parallel. But H parallel, I'm sorry, E parallel just outside is controlled by H parallel just outside, as we discussed, I guess, two lectures ago. So we can just calculate this, and it's an important quantity we'll be using later in the chapter. The rate of flow per unit time, energy flow per unit time, and per unit area. Remember, for monochromatic fields, we have the real part of the normal unit vector dotted into E parallel crossed into the complex conjugate of H parallel. Conjugated. And we can plug in then our formula for E parallel in terms of H parallel and get 1/2 the real part of mu C omega over twice the conductivity to the 1/2, 1 minus I absolute value of H parallel squared which is we can, if we have a real delta, right, delta is a skin depth, and conductivity, we'll have 1/2 1/2 delta sigma H parallel squared. And another way to write that is as mu of the conductor omega skin depth over 4 H parallel squared. So that's probably the form that we'll use later in the chapter, is this result. There is one other thing. We saw for a perfect conductor, sigma is infinite, right? Then the skin depth goes to 0, H parallel drops immediately to 0 past the surface. But the only way that makes sense with our boundary conditions is if there is a surface current. Now, as Jackson points out, when you have finite conductivity, there can be no true surface current that's, you know, exactly limited exactly to the surface. However, you can sort of integrate with this region over the skin depth and interpret that essentially as a, viewed kind of qualitatively at least, as a surface current. So that he calls, I think, K effective for a finite conductivity surface is defined to be the integral 0 to infinity going into the conductor, although the integral will only be appreciable within the skin depth. And you can calculate J dc over that part of the current. And then, because we have Ohm's law, this is related to the electric field components parallel to the surface, which is in turn related to, given by H parallel at the surface. And so you could also express the rate of energy loss at the surface as 1 over twice sigma delta, this K effective vector squared is another way that might sometimes, in some cases, be a useful way to represent the losses. Losses are going to be important. Okay, now I think we're back to the material. By the way, the next homework assignment is posted, and my solutions are posted to the first set. And the next homework is due a week from Monday, unless we have 2 or 3 more killer snowstorms. So there were some of the interesting results that were proved in that last lecture, talked about, derived, was, for instance, the non-existence of TEM modes if you have a waveguide. Remember, a waveguide, something like this, constant cross-section extended through one coordinate, which we are usually calling the Z coordinate. If you have this geometry with a hollow inside conductor, there are no TEM modes possible. And this was proved in the notes and in Jackson, basically because the boundary conditions are the same as in electrostatics. And if you only have one conducting surface, you can't, you can only get the trivial solution of a constant potential. And that leads to zero fields inside, which is the trivial solution of no physical interest. You could get a TEM mode if you make it have a second bound, second conducting surface, like inside. Then in this region, you could have a TEM mode. So keep that in mind. Most of this chapter, we're talking about the simpler situation where you don't have this inner conductor. Then the other things derived in this chapter, again, for the case of the hollow waveguide, surrounded by a conducting surface, and we're deriving the boundary conditions for the case of infinite conductivity now, is we're going to need the boundary conditions to find the transverse structure of the waves. Remember, we're writing here now in all of this, we're writing E as an E transverse plus a component of E parallel to the z-axis. And similarly with H or B, break it up into transverse vector components and z components. And all of these have this z dependence of e to the ikz tacked on to every field. K could be positive or negative, I should say. And of course, these are monochromatic waves, so they're minus I omega t as well. So the boundary conditions we're going to have to impose that were derived, I think that's about the end point of last lecture, is the normal derivative at the conducting surface and that means normal pointing in this two-dimensional cross-section pointing out of the conductor, that's my n hat, out of the conductor into the vacuum or the medium in the hollow region. That derivative on the conducting surface has to vanish for the B field, and for the electric field, that has to vanish at the surface. These are the key boundary conditions. So we're going to need to solve for these fields. And another useful thing that was derived somewhere back there in that material is that if we can calculate these parallel components to the z-axis, these z components, that's enough to determine the transverse components. And those formulas are there, and later I have a summary of all these crucial formulas. Maybe it's on page 23 of the notes, which I even recommended that if you are solving homework problems and stuff, that you print this out and have it handy, because it's got all these, like for instance, the formula for ET related to the gradient of EZ, transverse gradient of EZ, and the transverse gradient of HZ, and so on. Okay, so this boundary condition by itself, let's say, pick one of these, let's pick the EZ boundary condition. This would by itself plus the wave equation that has to be solved, del transverse squared that we derived last time, gamma squared Ez, which is now a function of the transverse coordinates, call them x and y, or they might be rho and phi if it's a round cylindrical end cap, circular cylindrical end cap. We're going to be solving this equation with this boundary condition, and that's enough already without even knowing this boundary condition on B to find the eigenmodes, to find the allowed eigenvalues, which are the eigenwave numbers squared that characterize the modes in the transverse direction that can obey this boundary condition and the two-dimensional Laplace equation. So this second equation is irrelevant for finding modes with Ez non-zero inside. And similarly, this boundary condition on Bz is enough combined with the wave equation for Bz, the Helmholtz equation for Bz, that's enough to determine uniquely eigenmodes and eigen squared wave numbers for a mode that has Bz non-zero in the interior. And so, in fact, if you specified both of these, this would overspecify the problem. And so this is why we treat these two cases separately. When we're imposing this boundary condition and solving the Laplace equation, 2D Laplace equation for the Z component of the electric field, when we're doing that, right, there is no the electric field is purely transverse, but the magnetic field is not. So we call this the transverse electric modes, because there is no parallel to the waveguide propagation direction. There is no component of E in that direction. And we call this the transverse magnetic modes that will obey that boundary condition, and then we'll be solving the Laplace equation for Bz. In either case, we have this equation, like from this page 23, it's also one of the circled pages in the last lecture, circled equations. Once you know either Ez or Bz, depending on which case you're calculating, then you can calculate everything inside. So that's the big picture of the logic here. Now, I should maybe remind you that there is the total wave number will be the total squared wave number will be the square of the Z component, which is what we call K without a Z subscript. Then there's the transverse components of the wave number, wave vector squared, which are referring right to motion sideways, those waves going in this direction. And this is what has to equal omega squared root mu epsilon, which is, I guess, written somewhere either in last lecture or this lecture. Which is, of course, also n squared over c squared in the interior, in the hollow region, or not necessarily hollow, but could have some medium in here with some mu and some epsilon. Okay, so we're going to solve for the transverse magnetic modes, and they will obey they will obey BZ sorry, did I get this backwards? Yeah, I think I often do this because, yeah, easy is zero. That means the electric field is zero. Oh, yeah, I'm mixing up the values on the surface with the values in the interior. So let me say it a little more carefully. I confused myself. Transverse magnetic modes TM, right? These have BZ is zero everywhere inside. And EZ on the surface is zero. But EZ is non-zero inside. And so that's what we're going to actually be solving for. In the transverse magnetic case, we're solving for the Z component of the electric field inside. In the other case, the transverse electric waves or modes, the TE modes, there's no EZ at all inside. So we'll be solving for BZ subject to this boundary condition that its normal derivative, again, normal in this two-dimensional domain, is zero. These will give two different sets of eigen wave numbers, gamma squared. There'll be an infinite set for each type of mode. And one can prove that for such a waveguide, these are complete. They're also going to be orthogonal. And you can describe any electromagnetic phenomenon inside as a linear combination of those eigenmodes. All right. So we're going to solve for at least some simple geometry, and I think in the homework you get to do the circular geometry, which will give you a chance to remember your Bessel functions. And it's hard to have more fun than that. But one interesting way of approaching this, I'm following Jackson in doing this, is to develop a unified notation. Where we will call psi when we are solving for the TM waves, call EZ psi. So it reminds us more that we're solving a normal Helmholtz equation for a scalar function. Remember, EZ is a function of x and y, or rho and phi. It is just a scalar function, this one component, even though it's the component of a vector, we can just think of it as a scalar function, this one component. And this is the relevant thing we have to solve for in the case of TM waves, where there is no BZ. BZ is zero inside, so we don't bother solving for it. But we do have to solve for EZ. And once we have EZ, we can find all the components, all of the transverse components. And if we recall then 826A in the text, we will then, after we find psi, we'll have the transverse electric field will be IK over gamma squared for these monochromatic waves. The transverse gradient of EZ, okay, or the transverse gradient of psi. And again, gamma squared is mu epsilon omega squared minus K squared. Will tell us then, once we find the eigen gamma squareds for TM waves, that will tell us the Z propagation wave number at this frequency. And we'll say more about that later. And moreover, the transverse B field, of course, is not zero, and it's given by these equations derived last time, mu epsilon omega over k, z hat cross the transverse E field, which is also, we have a linear medium in the hollow region inside the conductor, and so that is, of course, mu times ht. So this means we can write ht as epsilon omega over k z hat cross et. And it's useful to write this as z hat over a new constant that we'll be referring to, capital Z cross et. I'll give an equation for capital Z later, but at the moment I'll just mention that this will be a different constant for TM and TE waves. We'll have a similar equation to that for TE waves. Okay, so now let's jump over to the TE case where now EZ is zero everywhere inside, and refer to 826 equation B of that. Then B transverse, after we solve for BZ inside, will be IK over gamma squared for that, for each mode, the transverse gradient of this scalar function BZ. And so we could do similar thing we did with when we did for TM and call psi the solution of the Helmholtz equation. We could call BZ psi, but Jackson, usually HZ is of more interest because that controls the energy flow. So Jackson sets psi to be hz for TE waves that we're going to solve the Helmholtz equation for psi for the TE wave case, just with different boundary conditions than in the TM case. All right. Then once we have HZ, we can calculate B transverse or H transverse, and also then it implies the value of E transverse is minus omega over K Z hat cross B transverse. Of course, you're not going to memorize all these equations, but it's good if you have a place like this, page 23 in the notes, where you can look it up every time you need it. A few other relevant equations are also sometimes need Z cross ET, which is minus omega over K Z hat cross BT, which is omega over K B transverse, which is mu omega over K H transverse. So we can write like we did here, where we had this relation between H transverse and E transverse specified by this quantity Z that has the units of impedance. We can do something similar here and write HT as Z hat over a constant capital Z crossed ET. In the same form, except this constant Z is different in the TM and TE case. So capital Z is K over epsilon omega for TM waves, and it's mu omega over K for TE waves. And Jackson calls this the wave impedance. And in both cases, we're solving for del squared plus gamma squared psi is 0 with the appropriate boundary conditions. Either psi on the surface is 0, which is the TM case, or d psi dn is 0, which is the TE case. I think that's right. Now we are solving then Laplace's equation in some two-dimensional domain. Usually you won't be handed a complicated geometry like that, at least in this course. If you are, you'll probably turn to some finite element code that you can buy. All the engineering EE departments have these codes you can access, probably for free. I don't think I can in physics without paying money, which I tried to avoid doing. But I don't normally have to do that on a daily basis. But to find eigenmodes of Laplace's equation in a domain like that, What are we expecting? We expect it's an eigenvalue problem. Our Helmholtz equation, del squared plus gamma squared zero. We want to find these eigen squared wave numbers, gamma, lambda squared, and the corresponding eigenfunctions. And we expect oscillatory solutions, of course. Which is what you get with the Helmholtz equation in any number of dimensions. If you write the eigenvalues in this form as a squared number plus the Laplacian, and we will expect solutions like maybe the lowest one to be nodeless, just like in the quantum rules you learn. Probably be nodeless, maybe in both directions. Then the higher modes will have one node, two nodes, and then eventually you have an infinite number of nodes in here. So that's the nature of the problem you're solving. There will be infinite number of such nodes, because it's in a closed domain, it will have a countable infinity of modes. So we could label those lambda is 1, 2, 3, and so on. All these eigenmodes. And these are what are called the modes of the waveguide of either TM or TE type. And once we found those, then the Z propagation waveguide, which will tell you the phase velocity and the group velocity of a wave going down the waveguide, you won't be able to calculate it until you know these mode wave numbers. The Z propagation will be mu epsilon omega squared minus gamma lambda squared. And of course, k lambda squared better be greater than or equal to zero, or probably even greater than zero, to really allow propagation of mode lambda. Right, e to the ik lambda z is what is going to be the z dependence of this mode wave function, with k lambda either the positive square root or the negative square root of this, depending on whether it's going to the right or to the left of these waves. And if it's negative, then this would have exponential damping, and you would not really be able to propagate over a very extensive distance. So if you get a real k lambda, we call this a propagating mode for this frequency. And if k lambda squared is negative, so k lambda is imaginary, then we call it an evanescent mode, because it's exponentially damped and does not propagate beyond a very tiny distance. They're also sometimes called a cutoff mode for this frequency if the k lambda is imaginary or the So let's just do a little more of the math. If k lambda squared is equal to this, then you can see that for any gamma lambda squared, there will be a lowest frequency for which omega, for which k lambda squared is positive. And you'll want, if your goal is to send waves down this waveguide, you'll want to work in a frequency range where k lambda squared is real. So we can define a cutoff frequency omega lambda as gamma lambda over root mu epsilon. And only if omega is greater than that, as we can see from this math, take the square root, k lambda is then root mu epsilon omega squared minus omega lambda squared square root, right? And now it's easier to see that for omega greater than omega lambda, this cutoff frequency for mode lambda, only then do we have propagating waves. And for omega less than omega lambda, we have non-propagating or cutoff or evanescent mode, behavior of that mode. So if we take one of these, either TM or TE, and we look at, after solving the eigenvalue problem for the gamma lambda squared, the transverse squared eigen wave numbers, right, can plot the omega lambdas, omega 1, the lowest one, the next lowest, and so on, third lowest, which you have to find by solving the Helmholtz equation with the boundary conditions. And we could plot this dimensionless quantity k lambda over omega root mu epsilon. And here's 1 in these units. Then, as a function of omega, you will see that coming in with infinite derivative, like a square root function, this is what the k lambda over omega root mu epsilon looks like. And then there will be a similar curve for each mode, coming in with a square root behavior, so with infinite derivative. And one thing that's interesting about this is that often you want your waves to have a really simple structure, like in a single mode laser. You want to have just a very, very kind of smooth behavior in both coordinates. You don't want this mixed in with, you know, maybe another mode that's oscillating like crazy. This will lead to a very much more complicated and less stable, usually, behavior of the waves traveling down the waveguide. Like, and so it's often desirable to work in a single mode regime, and that would be this region, between the first cutoff frequency and the second. And that's the region of single mode operation. Again, you can propagate here, but again, your losses are probably going to be higher, and the stability of your fields inside the cavity, inside the waveguide, will be it'll be less stable. So let's talk about how these waves are going to go down once you've found these eigenvalues, gamma lambda squared. How do the waves propagate now in the z direction? Let's look at that. Let's find, for instance, their speed. their velocity. So the first thing we might calculate is the phase velocity. In Z. And of course, this will be different for every mode. And it'll be different depending on frequency. So you can look at the Z behavior, KZ minus omega T, and rewrite that as e to the ik lambda times z, I wrote x for some reason in my notes, z minus the phase velocity times time. All right, so the phase velocity will be omega over k lambda. Just 1 over root mu epsilon. And in terms of the mode cutoff frequency omega lambda, there'll be a root 1 minus omega lambda squared over omega squared. So this, remember, this is the speed of light over the index of refraction, this 1 over root mu epsilon. And normally, n is greater than or equal to 1 in most media, most normal media. But because omega is greater than omega lambda, this number circled here is greater than 1. And so the phase velocity can be greater than the speed of light. And in fact, it usually is. Faster than the speed of light in the medium of the waveguide, which if it's vacuum, it's even faster than the true speed of light. And moreover, you can see because this goes to zero at these points, this k lambda. Actually, Vp, the phase velocity, goes to infinity as omega goes to omega lambda. So that's fun. Let's send some stuff faster than the speed of light. Of course, energy won't be transmitted faster than the speed of light. Thank you, Albert Einstein, wherever you are. That is controlled by the group velocity. So let's work that out. We have omega of k lambda. Can write it this way, k lambda squared plus gamma lambda squared to the 1/2, 1 over root mu epsilon. And if you remember, the group velocity of waves is defined as the derivative d omega dk lambda. And that derivative, maybe I'll spare you, I'll just differentiate that, is 1 over root mu epsilon k lambda over k lambda squared plus gamma lambda squared to the 1/2, which is also c over n k lambda over k lambda squared plus gamma lambda squared to the 1/2. And so, in the usual case where n is greater than or equal to 1, the index of refraction greater than or equal to 1, this translates into a group velocity less than or equal to the speed of light in vacuum. Basically, for all real gamma, lambda, and k lambda. All right, those are the basic starting points for understanding the mode structure of modes that want to travel down such a conductor waveguide, conducting waveguide. And I think it's helpful to see a concrete case, which will do the simplest case, the rectangular waveguide. So, imagining a conductor, usually it has fairly thin walls. I'll draw the rectangle of finite thickness walls and set up my coordinate system in the inside area, because that's our boundary. This will be the y-axis. This will be the origin, right? This is conducting material. For now, we're still doing infinite conductivity, and we'll see how to generalize this to get large but finite conductivity later. This will be our y-axis we'll pick. This will be our x-axis, and let's define our dimensions. Let's say it goes y from 0 to b and x 0 to a. All right, so let's solve for the TE modes first. For TE modes, we said psi will be hz. The solution, the eigenmode solution for the two-dimensional wave equation, Helmholtz equation. And it's PDE in Cartesian coordinates. Is that clearly that's going to be separable in Cartesian coordinates. We're going to have separable solutions. The boundary conditions we have to impose are d psi dn is 0, so that means d psi dx is 0 at x equals 0 and x equals a, and d psi dy is 0 at y equals 0 and y equals b. You all know how to find separable solutions to such a PDE. So you can almost, once you've done this a few times, almost write it down by inspection. You have separable PDE, and it's important, separable boundary conditions. If either one of those are more complicated or you have a more complicated geometry, it will eliminate the possibility of solving it by separation of variables. Right, like if I had a stadium or an elliptical geometry, it's still true the PDE itself is separable, but the boundary conditions are no longer separable in Cartesian coordinates. Okay, so I claim the solutions of that have to be characterized by two indices or quantum numbers. If you don't mind me using quantum language, which you're probably more used to. There are two mode quantum numbers, indices, characterizing the eigensolutions. So we'll write the actual solutions, psi mn of x, y. And these will have some arbitrary overall constant that has dimensions of magnetic field H. So I'll call it H naught. And there should be a cosine in order to have zero derivative at A and in x and zero. We can make it m pi x over a. For the x solution, m is an integer, and cosine n pi y over b for the y dependence, where n is an integer. And then the squared wave numbers will equal pi squared times m squared over a squared plus n squared over b squared. And now we have to find the values of these indices, these quantum numbers, if you like, even though it's classical. So, of course, if you had negative values, they would have no more information than the positive integers. So we'll only need to consider non-negative choices for m and n. But we always have to be a little extra careful when zero is a possibility. We have to look at that with a little extra care to see whether it is actually a non-trivial solution or not. Just like in quantum mechanics, you have to find the range of the quantum numbers, of the indices. The lowest mode, of course, will have zero for both. So what is the nature of this psi 0, 0 of x and y, right? This is just a constant. If you look at the cosines of zero argument. And this gives zero transverse fields inside ET and HT or BT. And so this is like in quantum mechanics, you call such a solution the trivial solution. It has no physical relevance. So the solution where both m and n are zero is discarded and not really even included in our list of solutions. Right, and so our cutoff frequencies, omega mn, are going to be pi over root mu epsilon, m squared over a squared plus n squared over b squared to the 1/2. And let's, for definiteness, say a is greater than b. Just to make it concrete about, help us identify which is the lowest frequency mode, which you need to know if you're aiming for single mode operation. So then the lowest mode, if, as I said, A is greater than B, will have m equals 1 and n equals 0. And the cutoff frequency for that lowest mode which is the lowest frequency you could send a wave down this waveguide, is omega 1 comma 0, whose value is pi over a root mu epsilon. Since gamma 1 comma 0 is pi over a, and k 1 comma 0 for the z wave vector to propagate down the mode will be real if your frequency is above that cutoff. You can also work out HT explicitly using one of these formulas derived last time, IK over gamma squared transverse gradient of HZ, since EZ is zero. And, well, I wrote the formula in the notes. I'm not sure you really want me to rewrite it. There's an IK MN, a gamma MN. There will be, of course, a unit vector in the x direction, and then an m pi over a sine m pi over a, m pi x over a cos n pi y over b. And then there'll be a y hat and like an n pi over b from the y derivative, cosine and a sine. Anyway, we don't need to analyze that. And hz, as we found, is very simple for that lowest mode. This z component of h with m equals 1 and n equals 0 is simply an overall constant that will depend on how hard you're sending in energy into the waveguide will control this constant. And then you'll have the cosine of pi x over a z hat. And H transverse for this 1-0 mode will be minus IK 1 comma 0 over gamma 1 comma 0 squared H 0 pi over A sine pi X over A X hat. There's that, and then the electric field has only a transverse component, which is minus omega mu over k 1 comma 0 z hat cross ht 1 comma 0, which will look like constants times y hat sine pi x over a. And EZ, of course, for this mode is 0. So those are the main equations. Might be useful to talk for a minute about this. So we have a linearly polarized TE mode inside now. One thing that you might wonder about, what does this mean? We're sending in a wave. Okay, we have a rectangular cross section. We're sending in this electromagnetic wave. It's trying to propagate. It has an E field at right, oscillating at right angles to the propagation direction. But the H field is not entirely at right angles. It has a component along the propagation axis, which is very different from what we're used to thinking of an electromagnetic wave in vacuum. One way I like to think about this qualitatively is kind of from a ray picture of what the modes are doing. You can write the waves as a combination of, in the sort of Feynman path picture, of rays going down the waveguide, and then it might look something like that, right? And for each ray, you would have maybe an orthogonal fields to the propagation axis, so at right angles, transverse, in other words. But because they're kind of bouncing as a photon bounces up and down the walls as it's traveling, it will have a component along the propagation direction. That's how I kind of rationalize what it means to have a component of the fields along the propagation axis. A few more notes about this. So first, all the fields we're talking about have this extra factor, e to the I k10 z minus omega t. Second, there is a factor I, which is kind of interesting here. What does that mean? This factor of I implies there's a 90 degree phase difference between the transverse electric and magnetic fields. Sorry, that is not right. It's between Hz and either Ht or Et. Sorry. There's a phase difference between the parallel z component of the field and the transverse fields. If there was a phase difference between Ht and Et, that would be more like a circularly polarized wave. But this one is a linearly polarized wave in the transverse direction. Third point is, I'm not going to rederive the equations for the lowest, for the TM modes. Remember, they are found by setting psi to easy, and basically all your cosine solutions have to be replaced by sine solutions in the solution we worked out for the TE case. And for that case, for TM, the lowest mode, which is not trivial, has to have both n and m non-zero. So it has n equals 1 and m equals 1 sine functions. Right? If one of those were 0, it would kill the whole sine function, and it would not satisfy the boundary conditions. Okay, I think we're about out of time now. The next time we will do the energy flow down the waveguide and attenuation when the conductivity of the waveguide is not infinite. We'll have to calculate how fast you lose all your energy, which is really important if you want to send energy down a waveguide, and I know you all do. Okay, that's heavy stuff. Thanks for hanging in there.